Hey, 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 guys. Welcome to Building This Community.
This is your city business and policy development podcast. We're your hosts,
Luke Patrick
and Andrew Klump. Welcome to this week's episode of Building This Community. Our guest today is Casa Herron. She is a community activist, writer, and speaker. She's also the president of the Louisville Community Grocery. With that said, Casa, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Casa, you're a community activist, writer. You know, as Andrew said, you do a lot of speaking. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background in your own words?
Yes. Born and raised in Richmond, Kentucky. That is the county that's just south of Fayette County, down 75. I came to Louisville in 97 to attend the University of Louisville, and I've stayed ever since. I cut my teeth as a community leader or an organizer on campus and really continued that work after I graduated. I decided I wasn't going to pursue a master's degree in teaching. I was, after changing my focus a couple of different times, I decided I was going to teach middle school math and English. And then when I graduated, I decided I wasn't going to do that after checking out a couple of schools. And I landed a job as a community organizer with a group called Community Farm Alliance. CFA is what I'll say for short. It's a statewide membership organization that has been supporting small farm families for nearly 40 years. And I came on with the organization to organize a farmer's market in the Portland neighborhood after the state allocated half of our state's portion of the Master Tobacco Settlement Funds into agriculture diversification. So farmers in Kentucky have been focused on tobacco, had been focused on tobacco. And after NAFTA, and when the tobacco companies were found to be lying about tobacco addiction, they had to pay the states money around the health funds that states were paying to take care of people. And so in Kentucky, we made sure half of that money was put back into agriculture so that farmers could continue growing things. And CFA's membership wanted to see that the growing of things was going to be food, and food that's good for us and not tobacco. Mm-hmm. And so I came into that work in that backdrop, and for the past 20 years have been really working to see that vision come to life, to see our rural cousins, as I say, growing an abundance of products that infiltrate our cities and feed our communities again.
So you clearly have a deep background in community economics and agriculture, I would say. So now you're currently the president of the Louisville Association of Community Economics, and you're heavily involved with the Louisville Community Grocery. Can you kind of talk about how you got there and then what those two entities are and how they work together?
Yeah. So when I was doing the farmers market work, I did that work for a couple of years. The first week after the Portland market was open, I got a call from Miss Ella Roberts, who has since passed. She was a leader in the Shelby Park neighborhood. And she said, if Portland can have a neighborhood farmers market, so can we. Come over and see me. And so I came to see her. And then the next season, we opened up that market. And those neighborhoods were really organized. Folks in Portland have been organized, and folks in Shelby Park and Smoketown, they hadn't really known or met each other. And so this was an opportunity for them to learn from each other what they had been doing. And they were really interested in not just food in their neighborhood, but really commercial development, really investment in their neighborhood. And they start talking to me about things that I didn't know anything about, land bank properties and planning and zoning. I discovered urban planning as a discipline and went to grad school and came back and worked for metro government and economic development for a little under 2 years under Abramson's last term before merger. Merger had happened. And what I saw and what I've continued to see is this talk about food. There was an acknowledgement that people in our communities didn't have food. And Mayor Fisher ran on a local food platform. And what we've seen over the past 10 years of his administration is a new term, bourbonism. We've seen a lot of hotel developments. We've seen investments in sports arenas. And we've seen our grocery stores continue to close. We have not seen new grocery stores open, even when our local elected officials promised that there would be one in the Omni. Even the folks that rent condos for $10,000 a month in the Omni don't have a good grocery store in that development. And so my friends and I decided that we were going to do something to change that. And we literally just started meeting each other's kitchen tables and talking about this thing that was happening, all these stores closing. We found a book called Collective Courage by Jessica Gordon Nimpart. And it's all about the history of Black communities using cooperative economics as a tool for existence, pulling resources, your financial resources, your social capital together to solve the problems in your neighborhood. And so we quickly started learning about cooperative grocery stores, or just the notion of cooperative economics. And then we learned more about cooperative grocery stores. And then very specifically around cooperative grocery stores that were opening in urban neighborhoods, and found that we are amongst a class of several folks across the country who are using this model to solve problems in our neighborhoods that have been there for a very long time. And so we've been organizing for, I guess this is going on 6 years now. We spend a lot of time in neighborhoods that have seen their grocery stores leave, and neighborhoods who had been members of New Roots Fresh Stops. We started in those neighborhoods because people didn't have groceries and they were already using cooperative economics to get food with New Roots. And spent a couple years just talking to those folks and talking with them and building and figuring out how we would do this together. We are now in the pre-development stages of building the Louisville Community Grocery. We're looking at a few sites for the grocery store. And Lace, as the nonprofit developer, is continuing to grow, starting to listen and hear from other people who want to use cooperative economics to open other businesses. We're well on our way.
So, I mean, that's a phenomenal grassroots story, and I love seeing the community come together like that to solve issues. Do you see, so is Lace then the nonprofit arm that is trying to supplement, or what is that relationship like with the Louisville Community Grocery?
Yes. So what we learned, so we just set out to open a grocery store. And what we quickly learned is that cooperative grocery stores that are successful operate in an ecosystem where they can do business with like-minded businesses, often other cooperatives. And what we also learned is that these types of community owned entities don't start alone, that there is some entity that helps support them, whether it's a nonprofit community development organization or foundations have helped provide support and staff. And so we have been trying to raise money for like 5 years, $50,000 for a person. And we quickly became our own capacity builders. We were doing the research and quickly learned that we weren't going to be able to work through another nonprofit who didn't have the same specific vision of using cooperative economics to solve community problems and to educate the community about that, and that we were doing that work. And so we incorporated Lace in 2017 to be the nonprofit that is educating our community about cooperatives and then helping to incubate specific cooperative entities. And then we incorporated the business, the Louisville Community Grocery, last summer.
So, to put kind of a label on the specific problem that this is trying to address, would you define it as a food desert? And if so, could you maybe give like a little definition in your eyes of what a food desert is, and maybe kind of specifically how the Louisville Community Grocery can alleviate that type of problem?
Yes. So I describe our work as movement building work. and we are trying to change a part of our economy. We are trying to develop a business that's based on cooperation and not competition. And the first business that we are creating is the grocery store. I have never liked the term food deserts. When I was in grad school and I, you know, kind of did the research on that, there was, you know, a researcher out of Cornell, which is one of the schools I wanted to go to because of the land grant. It's got an urban planning school there. I didn't get in though. But Cornell, researchers at Cornell termed, coined the term food deserts to describe, a community that has limited access to food. And so I prefer to say neighborhoods with limited access to food. I heard one of the founders of the Movement for Black Lives, the person goes by M. I heard M a couple of years ago talk about why they didn't use the term food deserts, and it made a lot of sense to me. M is a scientist, and M said, food deserts are natural. They're natural habitats. And what we know about the term food deserts, or the neighborhoods that often are used, are called that. The neighborhoods aren't that way just because it's a natural phenomenon. There's policies and disinvestment that happen that makes it so that neighborhoods in some counties in Kentucky don't have grocery stores. So I choose just to say they're communities that don't have food or have limited access to food.
That is actually, I'd never even thought of that before. That is kind of enlightening, actually.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting way to contextualize it. I like that more, I think.
So with the Louisville Community Grocery, you are obviously still trying to fill those gaps in the community. How then do you see them also working outside just the grocery aspect, and then also working towards social and racial justice, maybe wealth creation along with that?
We're trying to help the community see and understand the value that we have in ourselves, the value that we have when we collectively work together, and how we can use that to leverage additional investment. So many times, and so oftentimes, people are put in a position to wait for someone else to do something for them. And particularly, I was really annoyed in the middle of the development for the Walmart at 18th and Broadway. I was one of the residents who filed suit in that around that development. And the only thing that we were asking was for our local government to stand up for us. Walmart is the biggest retailer in the world. The local government had been courting them for over 20 years to locate at that location. And when they finally said yes, they said, we'll say yes, but we're not gonna follow your local development laws or rules. And we need money to pay the poor Black people that are gonna shop at our store. And so our local government said, well, we'll give you $1 million to hire those folks. And yeah, you're right. You don't have to build to the street. You can build a 1990s version of a Walmart in the middle of West Louisville at 18th and Broadway, where there's more people that use the bus stop there than any other place in the county. Mm-hmm. And so it put us in a position where we're fighting against something, and where the community had to be divided around that fighting against something so that we could fight for something. And after that development did not happen, Walmart was never told no. Our planning commission said yes. The Board of Zoning and Adjustment said yes. Metro Council said yes. And when we filed lawsuit, the judge threw the lawsuit out. And Walmart still walked away from the deal. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself that I don't want, there's always going to be bad things that are happening in the neighborhood that we have to fight against. But I want us to be in a position where we're fighting for something and that we're creating a vision for what we want to see happen. And so the co-op is an opportunity for people to see the value that we have in ourselves, to not just open a grocery store, but there's tons of other things that we can do in our neighborhood together, in our neighborhoods and our communities together, if we leverage those resources, if we create a common vision and then invite other people to join us. It's a different model of development. And I'm hoping that what we're creating is an opportunity for people to become owners. That's what we are creating, and that people get an appetite of what ownership is and what it means to do the work, to create something new, to envision a new world, and that that grows and spreads throughout our community, and that we build community wealth in a different kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you maybe started to touch on this in the past, but just so everybody knows, do you have a location picked out yet for the grocery? And aside from that, what else do you need to get done before the community is ready to launch this project?
So the project has been launched. People can invest today. You can go to our website, Louisville Community Grocery, or maybe L-O-U-F-O-O-D co-op. .com. It's both. We're in the process of fixing our website. So, but it's active. You can go and invest right now. Shares are $150. That's one share per household. Your patronage, your investment, or what you get in return is based on how you support the store. And so it doesn't really make sense for households that have two shares. But what households who have the ability to buy two shares can do is purchase a share for our low-income folks. We have $25 shares set aside for seniors and for young people under the age of 20. And we're asking owners who have additional resources to purchase a $125 share, so that low-income folks can purchase a share for $25. And then there's tons of ways that philanthropy can invest in the grocery store and in Lace's work right now. We have a market study that we completed this spring that tells us that the corridors in Old Louisville and along West Broadway are corridors that are worth us finding a store where a store could be profitable that could compete with the Kroger or the Krogers that still do exist. And we are doing our due diligence right now with that market study to land on one of three properties that we're assessing right now.
Well, that's fantastic. And so it seems very accessible for people to get involved. Do you just want to give the plug again real quick for where people can go for more information?
Yes. So the project is called the Louisville Community Grocery, and we are on Instagram. We're on Twitter. We have a website. It's loufoodcoop.com. Yeah, and so folks can sign up to become an owner on the website. You can also sign up to pledge. If you don't have $150, where you can put down $30 and then pay on it as you go. We want everyone to have skin in the game. We don't want money to be a way in which people can't invest, but we know that everybody can't invest at the same level. So there's different ways that folks can get involved.
So I didn't mean to cut you off, but what are some of the benefits of becoming an owner, since we've talked about building this up as a community organization?
Well, right now, the benefit of being an owner is that you have the opportunity to build a new grocery store. Like, we have committees that are all around, like, what's going to happen in the store. And so there's an opportunity. I don't know of any other business that you can invest in and you can say, hey, this is the kind of greens that I want in the store, and this is what I want the shelving to look like. There's an opportunity for the community to do that right now. We're still sorting out what the benefits will be once the store opens. And again, it's an opportunity for folks who are investing in the store to help shape what those benefits are. For me, the benefit is that we're investing in a store that we will own, and that when the store becomes profitable, we get to decide what those profits look like, whether or not we split them up amongst the owners, or if we use those profits to invest in other businesses in our community. That's what I hope we do. We might invest in the upgrades in the store. We might invest in helping support the T-ball team down the street. There's tons of things that we can do by putting our money together. And we're asking folks to talk to us about what they want the benefits to be. Yeah, so there's a time to shape it all.
And I love this model for that very reason, that it gives more people a voice in the process and where their money's going. And so I'm very, very glad that you're starting this up, and also looking at LACE, Louisville Association of Community Economics, as almost an incubator as well. I mean, do you see that as incubating other cooperative businesses in the future?
Is this absolutely just a start? Absolutely. So right now, I've been thinking about a delivery business that would complement the grocery store. So the research that we found is that these delivery businesses are only 1% of the overall grocery store market. It's probably less than 1%. But when you get in communities, it's such a need. Transportation continues to be a need for folks in our community, particularly seniors and low-income single parent families. And so I envision young people on scooters and bikes delivering food, and they own that business. And so our work, LACE's work, is to educate the community about the power of community economics, and then really support folks who have a business idea, who want to utilize the model to solve other things. We bank with one of the credit unions right now. And so we're really looking for that opportunity to really do business with other cooperatives. We'll be working with groups of local farmers to pursue, to get our food. So in other projects that we've all been a part of, folks want to separate the need for folks that need food and farmer parity, fairness in the market. And we want this grocery store to do both. It's important that the grocery store provides access to food for people that's affordable and is high quality. And at the same time, we are supporting and providing a market for our regional brothers and sisters who are growing awesome food and who don't want to create new markets. They just want to drop the stuff off, and we want to be the place where they drop their stuff off.
You know, I've really enjoyed talking to you today. Unfortunately, our time's winding down, but before we can let you go, we ask all our guests this final question. If you had the power to change one policy, one thing about Louisville, what would it be?
Fire the cops that killed Breonna Taylor. That would be the policy.
I hear that. And I think a lot of Louisville's with you on that one. A lot of the country, maybe.
Yeah.
No.
Well, Casa, we appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks for the invitation. It was great.
We'll pick back up with our reaction segment after a word from our sponsor.
Luke, that was quite possibly my favorite interview we've done so far. Maybe I'm biased just because I'm so passionate about cooperatives, but I think the way that she explained what the Louisville Community Grocery does in such a succinct way, and with the passion of how it's really going to change people's lives and empower people, really just it's such an inspiring topic that has made me just very, very obsessed with this area of the law for a little while. Is there anything that stood out to you?
Yeah, I was kind of caught off guard by the discussion of how we define food deserts, or I guess the terminology we use when discussing these issues. Not something I'd ever thought of, before today.
Yeah.
And actually it makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And so between sessions, I actually called my old professor, Ariana Levinson, that she was the one that I co-authored an article with on this exact topic.
Yeah.
That's our white paper for today. And she kind of explained to me that it is now commonly referred to as food apartheid, because it's unnatural.
I like that actually a lot. I think it just as we discussed in the interview, it feels like when you call something a desert, it feels like there's no autonomy, no decisions went into creating that environment. Mm-hmm. But when you term it something like apartheid, or
it's purposeful.
Yeah, exactly. It makes it mm-hmm. feel like there was a premeditated like decision went into like creating that, you know, less than desirable situation.
Yeah. And the other thing, and again, because Levinson is, you know, national authority on cooperatives, she also kind of explained too that like that the U.S. Department of Agriculture still refers to it as food desert. So if you're doing actual research, you have to still use the word desert because of the way that the U.S. Department of Agriculture uses it. And but until that, maybe apartheid becomes the more common phrase going forward.
Yeah, I think it's easier to discuss it in those terms, you know, than it is going to be to like get a major U.S. federal administration to like change it. But no, I'm down to start the change. You know, like you gotta, it's gotta start somewhere.
Yeah, and exactly.
Like
Is there anything else that stood out to you as well besides the terminology?
I think just it for everybody's benefit, it's probably good to like dig a little deeper into the actual ownership structure on cooperatives, what makes them stand out, you know, as opposed to a traditional corporation, an LLC, a C corp, whatever.
Yeah. So from like the legal entity formation side of it, it's the Mondragon model is what most people follow in America, although that could be changing. And that's where the Mondragon is this cooperative of cooperatives, kind of like the UN, where each of the cooperatives have one vote that run this greater cooperative.
Federalism.
Yeah. Okay. And so, but each of those cooperatives are made up of individual people. And so you're seeing those in Massachusetts and Cincinnati and other places in that they are very much one person, one vote, and they all each have capital accounts. So each person, say you pay $100 to join, you are then getting a capital account for that amount of money or for whatever the predetermined number is. And then ultimately, maybe if you're getting patronage dividends, that's going up. They're treating it like some sort of savings account. And then when you choose to leave the cooperative, you cash out. And so you have that, and then you have the one person, one vote, which is really important because it's not even like an ESOP or some sort of other owner corporation where people can, as long as 51% owner of anything, that 51% can control. This is if there's 100 people, you literally have to get 51 other people to vote to get anything done.
Yeah. And so, I mean, like, and you just said it, but that's like the distinction between a publicly traded company. There would be one guy can own enough shares to basically decide, you know, to make the major decisions all by himself.
Yeah.
And that's not something that you'd run into ever really with a cooperative because you've liberalized the voting structure.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about it too is that even something as simple like as an ESOP, which is an employee stock ownership plan, is that's when people or companies will start selling more and more percentages to their employees, right, of that corporation. But even those, oftentimes the corporation still can have an owner of 51%. Like, this is the only thing that's truly getting towards that democratic environment. To be clear with what we've been talking about here and the Mondragon model, is that it has to be, in order to follow the Mondragon model, it has to be democratically run and voted on, and it would have the capital accounts. That's the model that's become very popular, which kind of leads me to my point that, so you have that legal aspect of it, but there's also like almost like a principles or fringe benefits of being a cooperative. So the National Cooperative Business Association also lines out 7 different principles of, you know, what it takes to be a cooperative. And I'm not going to go through all 7 here.
Yeah, just like the kind of the ideals the cooperative strive for.
So like, for example, one thing they provide is education and training. So if you're working for maybe a grocery store or working for a coffee shop or whatever, they might have open book management. So you're learning and seeing actually and having that democracy of seeing the business, but they also maybe quarterly or monthly providing financial literacy or some different type of educational class to have their employees then become more well-educated and can contribute more to the company or contribute more to their, you know, their personal lives or their business lives on the side.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of fringe benefits on top of the legal requirements. And the other aspect of it too is that you will also see entities. I don't know if you're familiar with Full Stop, because I know you live in Germantown, right?
Right.
They're not a cooperative officially, like by the entity, but
that's going to ruffle some feathers.
Well, but what they do is they have like promoted, and they've been in the Courier Journal and other local newspaper outlets of like, they follow cooperative principles.
Yeah.
So that's the distinction that not a lot of people get, is that you can still just follow these guidelines. You may not necessarily have the legal entity status, but like the ownership structure, but you can still follow the guidelines and still be a cooperative in that sense. It's just it's harder when you're doing both the legal side and the principal side and merging them together.
It's the difference between calling yourself a cooperative and being legally viewed as a cooperative.
Yes. Really? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, you can follow all of the rules or whatever, but if you aren't filing the proper, you know, documents with the Secretary of State, if you aren't going through the proper channels, like, well, your tax status is maybe not going to.
Well, and say you're following the principles, and say you, like, one of them is democratically owned. Well, if you're not actually a cooperative, you know, I could be the sole owner of this coffee shop and say it's democratically run and take a vote from everybody, but then at any point I could just choose and say, nope, I'm making this call.
Yeah,
you know, so that's part of it too, is that the legal entity status does put in more barriers to it. With that legal entity status, there's a couple ways you can proceed to have governance, and that is, you can have everyone vote democratically on every issue. You can have everyone vote democratically on the manager to make some of those executive decisions, and you can have everyone vote to create a board that picks a manager and makes those decisions that way. And the most popular way is clearly the board, right? Because if you didn't have the board, if you did like the very bare bones, just vote on everything, that can get kind of out of hand if you have more than, say, three people.
I mean, that would just be a bear. You can imagine trying to sort out like the decision-making process on every single aspect of a business, needing to run that by every single stakeholder in that business. That seems just almost nearly unworkable.
Yeah, like if you were at a coffee shop and we had to decide every time we were putting in a new order of coffee beans, decide what flavor everybody wants, that would be absurd. Yeah. But, you know, if you have a small business of three people, you can kind of get away with doing that, right? But if you get beyond that,
it's not scalable.
Yeah, and I think the board is more traditional and more, you see that, more favorable in the business world.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing, and this, again, this is really in the weeds, which, hey, I think that's the point of this policy podcast, I guess, right? Is that the thing that's been getting tinkered with in the American model is the capital accounts and investment. So what you're seeing now is you're seeing like this investor class, which the Uniform Limited Cooperative Association Act, which a number of states have taken, allows you to create, or cooperatives to create, this other class of investors, whether it's voting or non-voting, that they still would maximum get one vote, right? But what they could do is you could have potentially like three investors put up 90% of the funds, and then allow them to take a greater percentage back of the revenue for, you know, a certain period of time until they get paid back or they get a certain profit, if their goal is to create a cooperative and help people, but they still have to make, you know, their investment worthwhile for them too.
It's
kind of that bridge between, you know, what in newer areas that aren't aware of cooperatives and where there might not be federal or state or city grants, that it allows, it's easier for investors to get involved with that.
Yeah, it's kind of like the middle path between like a true cooperative and like an LLC.
Well, and ideally too, that investor class would slowly take away its power over time once the entity got fooled up, right? It would transition itself as far as the profits go. The voting rights would still be the same, right? There would still be one person, one vote. But that hopefully the percentage of investment would slowly transition out. Like that's the only way to really do it, if that makes sense.
No, I get what you're saying. I don't know if it's hard for me to imagine investors being that nice. I think a better way to do it is just to, you know, better publicize like the benefits of cooperatives and try and get them to go, you know, kind of follow a more traditional cooperative model. But I see what you're saying. Do you think that enough people involved in, you know, business side of things, like the lawyers and the accountants, do you think enough people know about cooperatives as it stands?
Yeah, I think that's tough. I think there is a really good network nationally that knows, and especially internationally, there's a great network internationally that knows how to do it. So you can, if you want to do digging, you can find it.
Yeah.
It's just more difficult in smaller cities to find those people. And even some of the bigger cities, it can be difficult to find if you don't know where to look. Yeah. And so that's why it's really important to have organizations and have cities develop these plans in order to help create cooperatives. So like, for example, Lexington, you know, a smaller city than Louisville, right, came up with this patchwork cooperative loan fund, which is literally, we just had an episode on sovereign wealth funds, right? And they literally put together a fund designed to give loans out to these cooperatives and help get them off the ground. I mean,
anytime you can create an incentive program like that at like the local level, like there's no question business is going to take notice. Investment dollars are going to take notice, and you're going to see like a huge drive into that, you know, investment type. So I think anytime a government can kind of incentivize like the shift into like a more equitable work environment, like I'm totally for that, you know.
Well, and I think what this gets to is that the nonprofit and profit or for-profit sectors,
yeah,
have been slowly merging more and more over time. For-profit companies now are putting in billions and billions of dollars into charitable donations of some kind. I mean, you just look at what Amazon just did, which was to get the naming rights to the new Seattle NHL hockey arena. It's called Climate Pledge Arena. And it just goes to show that this is more of that, even though that's not like an environmental good that they did, it's just more of like an awareness thing. It's going to see more of these for-profit companies at least attempting to mirror or look like nonprofit entities.
Well, there's definitely a benefit in a company trying to cultivate that socially conscious image. Amazon's not alone. You see a lot of for-profit companies shifting it to try and portray themselves in that manner to the public. I see what you're saying. I think as it stands right now, that's, you know, until we see like a shift in like the corporate culture in America, it's going to be hard to convince me that that's not just purely for tax purposes. And maybe like a little bit of PR or marketing.
It's branding, right? I mean,
it's branding. Yeah.
People under the age of, at least under the age of 30, if not older,
yeah,
are more tied to what a company's doing responsibly, yes, sustainably. Like, yeah, that is extremely important now. Like, and now you're seeing things with racial and social justice, like companies are having to take a stance on that too.
Yeah.
I mean, people are caring more and more about what corporations are doing. They don't have to be a benefit corp. They don't have to be a nonprofit. They have to take stances and actually give back to their communities now. I think they are starting to blend. I mean, yeah, more so than they were 20 years ago.
Well, and it's driven by the pressure of losing millennial and Gen Z business.
Yeah.
You know, it's a calculation on their end. I don't know that it's necessarily like this new drive in like the leadership to be more ethical. I think it's still like a preservation of the bottom line.
Yeah.
But that's fine. You know, as long as like the good result is, you know, is coming to fruition, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, that's fair. And to me, and also, this
maybe that's too cynical. I don't know.
True, but this was also a complete sidebar to where we were going to.
Yeah.
In that, I truly believe, even though they're blending, cooperatives are the bridge.
Yeah.
That if you wanted to go and if a city wanted to create a fund for cooperatives, you are helping entrepreneurs, you're helping social and societal needs. I mean, think about it. You're getting trained. Like, there, a lot of them provide training. That's part of the principles, right? So yeah, if you're providing financial literacy, that's one less thing the city has to do. And you're also helping to provide more jobs.
Oh, no, yeah, no question. I mean, even just like opening up your books, and if you're like involved in small business accounting, like, and you never had any background in like finance whatsoever, no background in accounting, like that alone could be so beneficial for like your average person. Like it's just something that isn't intuitive. Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't come natural, I don't think, for anybody. Even people that have a math background, like there's a lot of elements of accounting that just you need to be told, you know, or need to be explained to you. And like by opening up the books, it allows them to like ask questions. Maybe they're getting like direct education like regarding the matter. Yeah. It's a great thing.
But see, this is what reminds me too of what I wrote in an op-ed in the Courier about this exact topic.
Yep.
And basically, my main argument was both conservatives and liberals should be supporting the cooperative model, because if you're ultra liberal, you're probably a lot about wealth, like want to support, you know, the bottom line and helping create a higher floor.
Yeah.
And then as a conservatives typically don't like welfare programs, claim to be pro business too. And so here, you're shifting that off government reliance. You're doing like a one-time payment and you're starting and creating another business ecosystem, right? So ultimately, now if this was developed well enough to where it could, you know, maybe contemplate the need of welfare programs or something else like that, that's a debate later that conservatives and liberals can have.
Yeah, and I'm sure they would.
And they would. But ultimately, as it stands right now, there is not a single reason that both parties should not be supporting it. And to be clear, this is
something that they might enjoy about the benefits.
Yeah, and to be clear, this is not a political podcast. Like, this is a policy-driven podcast.
Yeah.
But there's no reason why any party would not support a cooperative at this point, because it just creates business and lowers the floor for economics. There's no other reason.
No. And if you want to read more about that, you can look up Andrew's article. Yeah,
we'll be attaching that to this link. Now, the last thing I would say is getting back to the investor members a little bit.
Yeah.
I still think that's going to be the main way forward, at least in America. You're just going to see that more and more for people that aren't in major cities. I think that's going to become more, unless you start seeing things like Lexington where they're doing these actual funds, or maybe you have a blend. But there are some really important societal needs that still need to be that grassroots section. And what CAS is doing with the Louisville Community Grocery and the Louisville Association of Community Economics, she and that group are doing the most important thing, because this is a particular area that has to be driven by the community more so than other cooperatives, because grocery stores are so big, have such massive impact for communities.
Oh yeah.
That it almost has to be a grassroots driven organization or movement.
Yeah. And that's when you talk about like the benefits of increased access to traditional grocers, it's like, it's just one of those things that, because the benefits are borne out over such a long period of time, like mm-hmm. the health benefits, like the economic empowerment that it can bring to a community, it's hard to calculate it, you know, and really convince the business community that like there is a tremendous benefit in doing this, you know. And so when you structure it that because the benefits are borne out over such a long period of time, it's a tough sell. Mm-hmm. Because like people are looking at like, you know, recouping their investment quick.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a time value of money.
Well, I think you're going to see more philanthropic. I mean, that's why I'm saying it's blending the nonprofit and the for-profit.
No question.
It's still like the philanthropic, but you can still get a certain percentage back. But I think the expectation is that you're taking a lesser revenue than you would from a traditional investment.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to help something be set up.
Yeah.
And that's not to say there shouldn't be tax incentives or other things with this that encourage that type. But that's also with, is America going to start tinkering with this model a little bit more and getting it there?
Is it the same as like preferred stock?
It's a similar model, yeah.
It's a similar concept. Yeah, that's kind of what I figured.
So, you know, you get 2x back until, you know, you get 125% of your investment. Yeah. And you can also do things too where they get maybe investors get one particular board member reserved on the cooperative that they get to exclusively pick. And now that may not swing things entirely, but that can still follow the cooperative principles for the most part and give one more incentive reason to bring on an investor. And the one last thing that I want to talk about with this is, you know, the different types. So you have worker and consumer owned. Since we're talking about investors, like that's the third class that's potential, but you have worker and or consumers. And so what you see with, for example, Mama's Hip in the Highlands in Louisville, that's a consumer cooperative where, you know, different mothers come in and they help with, I think, babysitting and other maternal needs, right? And then you have things where it's worker cooperatives, where it's actually, it would be like a coffee shop where you're having the baristas and the managers are the owners. Everyone's the owner versus a consumer co-op where it's everyone is a, that uses the service is an owner. Almost like a, almost paying like a membership, like to go to Costco, but you're getting an ownership stake in it rather than just paying to be a member there.
Yeah. Rather than being basically a subscription.
Yeah. If that makes sense. I hope that wasn't just like an over the top in the weeds conversation that we just had, but this is a policy podcast, I guess.
No, you sold me, man. I think we definitely need to see like a bigger investment in cooperatives from local and state governments. And I think we need to see more business owners or like potential business owners exploring this like means of establishing a business.
Well, and that's what I love about the idea of LACE is that it could be a potential incubator. I know Smoketown Hope Box is looking at being a little bit of an incubator with it too. So we have a couple of different groups in the city of Louisville looking to get into that actual incubation of cooperative market, which is just so needed. Now, the other aspect of it is, are we ever going to get Metro Council support and get a dedicated fund? Again, that goes back money. To you know, the current finances of the city.
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, government drags its feet and the funds don't materialize quick enough, that's when I think you can maybe explore some of that kind of investor, like, beneficial kind of hybrid system that you were discussing.
Yeah. And just to wrap it up a little bit, I think, again, getting back to what Cass is doing, is that the grocery model is so important for wealth creation. It's not wealth redistribution. It's wealth creation. It's providing more jobs with higher incomes, because instead of paying that one or two handful of people at the top, that money is getting put back into the business or being put out as patronage dividends to all of the owners of that cooperative.
Yeah.
And so what they're doing is they're creating wealth creation in the neighborhood that they choose to go into. And they're giving people in that neighborhood a voice. You know, if you're just a consumer, you're going to a grocery store and you say, oh, well, I wish you had a better selection of this. Are they going to listen to you? Probably not, maybe. But if you're an owner or a cooperative and you bring that up in a meeting and you say, hey, I wish you had better selections of seeds or of gluten-free options or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You're going to have a voice and you're going to get what actually caters to that community. And guess what? If you're catering to that community, your business should be better. You're not just having a generic, this is what all stores have. You're having something that specifically fits the community.
No, absolutely. I mean, that kind of – like tailoring the business model to fit, it sounds great.
It's hard to do, but with this cooperative model, it's better. And the last thing I'll say is that I've heard people in the past criticize this model because they don't see them be successful, right? And they've seen them fail in the past, and a handful that have popped up in Kentucky and other places close by. But the thing I say to that is, you know, a lot of businesses fail. It's not the model. It's not the entity model that makes a business fail a lot of times. And a cooperative would be successful if the business model is successful. So if you're a dry cleaners and you don't do a good job at cleaning clothes, guess what? That business is probably going to go out of business.
Yeah.
But here, cooperatives really just need to be given the chance. They just haven't had the volume yet that traditional businesses have to be successful. And so any stigma with them, to me, doesn't have any validation.
I agree with you, man. I'm right there with you. I think we're on the right path here.
Think we're good?
Yeah.
Nothing else to add today?
Yeah, nothing else to add on my end. You did a lot of the heavy lifting today, but that's because you wrote the white paper. Yeah. Plug it. I don't think you said the title.
It's Alleviating Food Insecurity Via Cooperative Bylaws.
Easy enough, man. That wraps it up for me, unless you have anything to add.
That's it, man. Thanks for tuning in, guys.
Yeah, thanks for listening. As always, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on Building This Community. If you'd like any more information, you can follow us on Twitter at BuildingThisCom, or you can follow Andrew
at Andrew J. Klump, and you can also follow Luke
at LMP43. Definitely subscribe, and we look forward to talking to you guys next week.